principal purpose of our voyage was not simply to gather the flora and fauna. That was my personal preoccupation. Rather, our mission was to explore and chart uncharted waters. To that end, the crew of the Beagle would drop a weighted line to the bottom and record the depth at regular intervals. The measurements were called soundings. They told us where we had been and would serve to guide those who followed.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, listen now to our program called Soundings. Thoughts and ideas about the present and the future with an appreciation for the past. Your host is Wayne Pond.
Soundings now presents a conversation with Professor Charles Berquist of Duke University, where Dr. Berquist teaches in the Department of History and serves as director of the Comparative Area Studies Program. Dr. Berquist was educated at the Universities of Chicago and Washington and at Stanford University, where he earned a doctorate in 1973. Professor Berquist specializes in studies of Latin American history, politics, and economic policy. He was a Peace Corps volunteer between 1963 and 1965, and he's traveled extensively in Latin America. Dr. Berquist is the author of two books and numerous articles about Latin America. His books are Coffee and Conflict in Colombia, 1886-1910, and Alternative Approaches to the Problem of Development. Dr. Berquist's research on 20th century Latin America deals with six case studies of workers in the export sectors of Latin American countries. Dr. Berquist, it's a pleasure to have you at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to our radio program, Soundings.
What does it mean for a country to be developed?
We have different ideas about this. Most people in the United States, I think of development in terms of automobiles and color TVs and probably industrialization and freeways. There are other ways to think about development. That is, I think most people would agree that a developed nation should have adequate food for its population, shelter, clothing, health, education, jobs for everybody. Now, if we take the first kind of definition, that is lots of things per capita, I remember when I was a kid, a textbook we had an appendix at the end and it listed, you know, number of cars and radios per capita. And of course, the United States was at the top of the list in every consumer good. If we take that definition, then of course the United States comes out to be the most developed nation in the world. On the other hand, if we think of development as including housing, health, literacy, and so on, the United States surprisingly does not rank highest, and in fact ranks below most Western European nations. And in terms of adequate housing and adequate health for everyone in the society, may rank lower than some nations we think about as underdeveloped ones, for example, China or Cuba, and certainly the Soviet Union. So that in a way there are kind of two definitions of development. There's a capitalist one, which is the one which places the United States first, and there's a kind of socialist one, which defines development in these more basic human needs. Of course, political scientists in socialist countries tend to emphasize the second set of criteria, whereas economists and political scientists in this country tend to emphasize the first.
Mm-hmm. How do you explain the truism that Latin America just seems traditionally to lag behind the United States? Why is that?
Well, again, there's a great debate going on. I think most of us have internalized an explanation for that. It's an explanation which we're taught in the schools and we read in the newspaper. It's often not explicit, but I think we have internalized it and we do have an explanation for why we are the richest nation in the world.
You mean we just assume it?
Yeah, we assume it and we don't examine it. And the bottom line of this explanation, I think, is cultural. That is, we think we're developed, we've made it, because we're more rational, we work harder, we're good at science and innovation, we have entrepreneurial skills, and so on. And in fact, when we teach modern history, or the history of the world, we tend to see ourselves as the heirs of Greek civilization, which of course had those, we think, we tell ourselves, had those values of rationality and science and so on. In U.S. history, the idea of manifest destiny embodies those same assumptions. Now, the interesting thing to me is that third world societies, third world thinkers, and among them prominently Latin Americans, have challenged this sort of traditional, cultural, and Western explanation of how things got to be the way they are. That is, they tend to point out that that this emphasis on culture is very close to racism. And of course, they want to deny that they're inherently inferior culturally or racially. And they have explained the division of the world into developed and underdeveloped nations as a historical process, which they date from about 1500. That is, precisely at the time that Europe begins to expand into what is now called the Third World.
Professor Berquist, there's a good deal of turmoil and instability, the problem of terrorism, revolution in Latin America. On the one hand, we have the Third World, or an element in the Third World, thinking of itself as not culturally inferior. The American perception is, well, just look at all of that mess down there. There's no stability. Why is that?
Well, of course, these are all difficult questions about which people have very different views. Third world thinkers explain the current political instability, or even the long-standing political instability in the third world, first of all, as an economic problem. That is, just as they explain the development of the West and their own underdevelopment in economic terms, so also do they explain the difference in political and cultural institutions in the developed world and the underdeveloped world. Let me give you an example. If you produced sugarcane for the world market to feed, say, the English working class, you evolved a society which was essentially two-class, what we think of as a plantation society, with a very rich few and a coerced mass of labor. Both of those forces tended to be democratizing influences over the subsequent centuries. So that the question of what we think of as developed politically, that is, stable political regimes, pluralistic ones, democratic participation, open societies, for third world thinkers, those characteristics are not, cannot be separated from these economic developments which have taken place over the last five centuries. The very same economic and social evolution of this worldwide international division of labor tended to not to favor those very developments in the third world.
Well, what do these third world thinkers want then, if they could come up with a wish list?
It involves some pretty radical changes. Because since their explanation of underdevelopment and the current state of affairs, including terrorism, is a function of the history of a worldwide division of labor, they want to attack that worldwide division of labor. That is, break the tie which has historically bound them to the developed world. So they want to do things like encourage industrialization at home, often in ways which are not acceptable to the United States
what
and
do
Western
you mean?
Europe.
What
for
do you
example,
mean?
High tariffs, the use of cartels such as OPEC, efforts to limit the freedom of action of multinational corporations.
But aren't these quick fixes, so to speak? Will they work in the long run?
Well, according to their analysis, of course, the history of this kind of relationship with the developed world has led to the draining of surplus out of the third world, has led to over-specialization in agricultural and mineral production, has led to this dichotomous social structure, which all of which tends to impede development. So they've reasoned in quite the opposite, that in fact, in the short term, things are going to be very difficult if you succeed in breaking this historical tie and breaking the structural relationship with the developed West. But in the long run, it is the only way to ever move toward real development.
What is the role of communism in all of this political and economic activity?
What we have is a cadre of intellectuals who analyze the situation as I've tried to convey to you. They are the dominant force in the universities and in intellectual spheres. On the other hand, there is great discontent on the part of the Latin American, for example, working class, third world, working people in the third world. And increasingly, over the course of this century, greater organization of those popular elements to challenge the status quo. As a result, you know, there is a considerable repression by the state of labor unions, of organizations of peasant farmers. There is repression in the universities. The universities in Latin America are closed as much as they're open.
Well, how best can this intellectual element, mm-hmm. whether it's communistic or otherwise, mm-hmm. how can this element talk to these deprived, underfed, underdeveloped elements of the Latin American population?
Well, they don't talk very well. And in fact, I think you could argue that, in fact, the intellectual developments mirror these more basic social forces. That is, the growth of popular organizations, and the pressures they're putting on. Intellectuals look around and see this and begin to think about the world in a new way. So I'm not sure that they talk very well to these new groups, for example, organized labor, but they do mirror the concerns of those groups and articulate them. And I think that that's the way to look at Latin American intellectuals, as kind of mirrors of the social reality they experience on a day-to-day basis. Now, it is true, of course, that there are links, political links through the Communist Party, through socialist parties, through reform parties in Latin America, and intellectuals do play an important role in that process.
Professor Berquist, is there a country or a part of a country, specifically in Latin America today, that you would point at and that you could say, here they're succeeding, whether it's, right. you know, whether they're doing it by U.S. standards or mm-hmm. or their own standards?
Well, the one which is most successful, certainly by U.S. standards, is of course Brazil. All you have to do is go to Brazil to realize the dynamism and the growth which that society is undergoing. And this is done through a kind of traditional development policy. That is, the creation of a favorable climate for foreign investment, the playing by the rules of the International Monetary Fund, squeezing of real wages for the working class in order to save, supposedly, and develop, invest in the economy and develop. This has, over the course of the last 15 years or so, has led to enormous expansion and development in Brazil. So that while there's great dispute over the social costs involved, and there is also great dispute over how viable this development strategy is in the long run. For example, were it unable to meet its international obligations, it could endanger the whole world monetary and banking system. So that's Brazil. So there is criticism both in terms of how viable it is over a long period of time, also criticism of how of the great human costs which are involved in this kind of development.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, you're listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation. Here again is your host, Wayne Pond.
Dr. Charles Berquist is a professor of history at Duke University, where he specializes in Latin American history, economics, and politics of the 19th and 20th centuries. Professor Berquist has written widely in various professional journals about Latin American political ideologies and the relationships between the United States and Latin America. Berquist is the author of Coffee and Conflict in Colombia, 1886-1910. He is currently a scholar in residence at the National Humanities Center. Dr. Berquist's discussion for the Center's radio program, Soundings, includes a description of political and monetary development by American standards and by standards as conceived by third world historians and economists.
Now, on the other side, I guess the best example would be Cuba.
You mean the definition of development in third world terms?
Yes, or in socialist terms. Mm-hmm. Cuba, of course, has severe economic problems. No one denies them. I mean, even Fidel Castro doesn't deny them. Nevertheless, it's apparent to anyone who reads the newspaper that Cuba has become a very dynamic society, a little tiny country playing a major role in world politics. Cuba has made enormous gains in terms of those basic human needs I spoke of earlier. For example, literacy. It has one of the highest literacy rates in the world. Public health. I noticed at the time of the Cuban refugee problem, recent Cuban refugee problem, that U.S. Immigration and health officials were amazed at the health of these rejects from Cuban society. That is, they were healthier than the average American. So this is a tribute to the health system, which has evolved under this socialist regime since 1960. Cuba, on the other hand, has made great efforts to diversify its economy. It has had massive Soviet aid to do so since 1960. It has not been overly successful. In a way, however, it's difficult to compare these two countries, Brazil and Cuba, because, of course, Brazil is one of the largest nations in the world, has enormous natural resources and diversified natural resources. It now is a larger sugar exporter than Cuba is.
If Cuba trades with the world and deals with mm-hmm. the world, mm-hmm. There's importation, exportation. It uses capitalist means to a socialist end. Is that not accurate?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I don't think that most socialist economic theorists advocate autarky in this day and age.
Now, what does that mean?
Autarky meaning closing yourself off from the whole world system. What I meant by third world development strategy trying to break or restructure the nature or the quality of the tie with the developed world, that's more what Cuba's tried to do. But of course, it's very difficult to do that. The costs are enormous. Cuba was the infrastructure of Cuba was so closely tied to the United States that when it was cut off or cut itself off from the U.S. market, it experienced enormous problems. For example, when you wanted supplies for a hardware store in Cuba, you just called Florida. and made an order just as you would if you were in Miami. Of course, when Cuba moved into the socialist bloc, it had not only no longer do that, but it had to make its requests a year in advance, because in socialist societies, planning is done that way. Cuba had no storage facilities for any of this. It would get its year shipment of nails, and had no place to put them. Because in fact, it had always depended on a marketing distribution system, which was fully integrated with the U.S. economy.
At the other end of the spectrum, which of the Latin American countries is most deeply in trouble?
Well, most Latin American countries are deeply in trouble. I think there's two main categories that might help us to sort this out. On the one hand, there are the larger nations of South America, relatively much more developed by either of the criteria we mentioned.
That would be Argentina, Brazil.
Chile we could put there, maybe even Uruguay. Colombia, I think you could put there, Venezuela. Mexico, which would not be in South America, but would fit the bill for these larger Latin American nations. In almost all of those nations, there has been great political instability in recent years, and the institution of very repressive regimes. First in Brazil, I guess, in 1964 with the coup there that began this process of capitalist economic development we talked about. Somewhat later in Argentina, of course, in 1973 in Chile, about the same time in Uruguay. Venezuela and Colombia have managed to remain relatively open societies, although especially in Colombia, repression of labor and dissident groups is increasing. So that for these larger countries, although the economic problems are very severe, we think of them as a little bit more viable economically, certainly the larger ones, and we focus on this relatively recent political regression, sort of, because many of these were open, pluralistic, and democratic societies in the 50s, for example. Now, the other group of nations are the ones that probably are concerning us more, certainly the State Department more these days, and that's the smaller Central American countries and the countries of the Caribbean.
Such as El Salvador.
Nicaragua. Mm-hmm. And of course Jamaica and the English-speaking islands as well. And now in these countries, of course, there is enormous amount of political instability today.
Is that because there are struggles within the groups running the country simply to get rich?
No.
And get out?
No.
Why is there a struggle?
In all of these countries, the constellation of political forces tends to be landowners and groups tied as exporters and importers to the developed nations versus those who have been marginalized and cut out of the benefits of the system, and that, of course, they include the large percentage of the people. So that we're talking about rural agricultural workers and, of course, urban labor.
And this is what gives rise to the oppression of labor.
Right, but the interesting thing, Wayne, is that while this process is going on in both categories of nations I've talked about, that is, there is repression of labor, there is great discontent and increasing organization by working class groups all over the Third World and all over Latin America. But what's interesting to me is that it's in Central America and the Caribbean where these pressures are not being contained. That is, in the larger Latin American nations, what we have is military regimes which have managed to contain these pressures, at least in the short term.
Well, why are they not being contained in these smaller countries?
I think the reason is that these smaller nations are much less viable economically. Now, let me give you an example. We talked about the size of Brazil. Well, that means that it has an enormous internal market. It has enormous resources which it can. One example is the fact that when Brazil was one of those third world nations which was hardest hit by the OPEC price rises because it's a major importer of fuel. But Brazil has the capability to turn to other sources and has mounted a really remarkable effort to make gasohol from sugar cane.
Coal is also a resource.
Coal is also a resource, and that's true in Chile and in Colombia as well. But the littler countries can't do that. And so when OPEC hit them, the economic and fiscal strains got very severe. And that's why the potential for revolutionary change is greatest at the present time, I think. There are other things involved which are mainly political, and that is the fact that the United States control and presence in the Caribbean and especially in Central America historically was much greater, so that there is a kind of target and a history of mobilization against the United States and those tied to U.S. interests in Central America and the Caribbean, which really doesn't occur to the extent to that extent in South America.
Is the United States the villain in Latin America simply because it was the firstest with the mostest?
Mm-hmm. I think that most people involved in making U.S. foreign policy toward Latin America have thought of themselves as high-minded, progressive individuals over time from the 19th century on. At the same time, they have pursued policies which have been designed to benefit primarily U.S. economic interests. That is, the study of U.S. policy toward Latin America reveals that what we call the free world, and what we think of as the free world, really means free and open for American economic interests. Because we have supported the most repressive and reactionary regimes who support U.S. economic interests.
You've been listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation in conversations originating from the National Humanities Center. Your host was Wayne Pond. We're interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Director of the center is William Bennett. Soundings is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California.
Soundings is made possible, in part, by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
This is Bill Bennett, Director of the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, with an invitation for you to listen this week for the Center's radio program, Soundings. What's going on in the politics and economics in Third World and Latin American nations? Well, this week on Soundings, Dr. Charles Bergquist, a scholar in residence at the Center, gives his view and some answers to these questions. Join us this week for Soundings.